This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we talk with one of the co-directors of a new group which, tired of waiting for legislators to act on what they think is the defining issue of our time, is launching a petition campaign to put a carbon tax on the ballot. And then we attend a book release party for the 90-year-old principal chronicler of the archaeological dig that has been called the Native American Pompeii, the Macaw Village of Ozette. So now, let's go inside the Compass. Tired of waiting for legislators to act on what they perceive as the defining issue of our time, a newly formed organization called Carbon Washington has taken aim at climate disruption and officially launched a signature-gathering campaign to qualify for the ballot, an initiative that would put a direct and escalating tax on carbon pollution, while at the same time reducing other taxes to assure that the measure is revenue neutral. Carbon Washington co-director Kyle Murphy came to town recently to help kick off the petition drive locally, and I took the opportunity to talk with him about the I-732 campaign.
Carbon Washington is a nonpartisan grassroots organization that's working on a revenue-neutral carbon tax. We're putting forth a ballot measure to be on the ballot in 2016.
How did Washington get its start?
One of the longest and leading members of the group is Yaron Bauman, he calls himself a stand-up economist, and he was actually a professor of mine at the University of Washington. So the organization's a collection of academics and activists and citizens who've been concerned about climate change for a long time and are putting forward this policy. And it's existed in different iterations for a few years, but we've been working on a specific measure for over a year now.
So tell me more about the measure. I mean, how does it work exactly? It's revenue neutral. How does that work?
So this measure implements a 1 percentage point cut in the sales tax across the state. It also funds a low-income tax rebate called the Working Families Rebate and cuts the business and occupation tax for manufacturers. And we pay for all of that with a $25 per ton carbon tax on carbon pollution.
I see. And the payers of that tax are the users of the fossil fuels. Is that right?
Well, the tax is levied at what's called the rack. So it's levied on oil refineries and utilities and the industries that are actually causing the pollution. But in all likelihood, some of those costs may be passed down to consumers. And the aim here is to offset those costs being passed down by the cut in taxes.
Well, will I be paying the tax to drive my gasoline-powered car?
In all likelihood, gasoline will see a slight increase, perhaps between 20 and 25 cents per gallon. But as I said, that should be offset by the cut in the sales tax.
I see. So you're launching this campaign now, but it's for the 2016 election. Is that right?
That's correct.
And you were talking before about it's being an initiative for the legislature. So why don't you explain the mechanics of that for me?
Sure. So the pathway is between now and December of 2015, the campaign has to collect 315,000 signatures from Washington residents. At that point, after the signatures are collected, the legislature can either pass the plan, pass an alternative, or ignore it completely. If the legislature ignores this plan, it'll go before voters on the 2016 ballot. We're hopeful the legislature will take a serious look at it. But traditionally, initiatives to the legislature end up on the ballot and the ballot afterwards.
But there is another option you mentioned, which is that they might come up with a sort of amended version of this. And what happens in that case?
Well, I think this is unlikely. It is possible the legislature could pass a similar climate plan, at which point the voters would get to choose between the plan we proposed and the plan the legislature proposed. I think that's fine, too, because the point here is to give voters a chance to decide on our tax code and whether we want to be reducing pollution and dealing with climate change. But the most likely thing is for this policy to show up on the 2016 ballot by itself.
So who's in your organization? How many are you?
You can look at our website, carbonwa.org, carbonwa.org. We have a small staff, and we have 15 plus, we're adding new ones every day, chapters across the state. So a chapter is a group of volunteers, anywhere from 5 to 20, who want to work on this campaign. So really the strength of the campaign comes from the fact that people all across the state are getting organized and they want to work on this. So yes, we do have a small staff. We do have committed volunteers, and we do have an executive committee, but the bulk of this campaign is run by volunteers out of their homes, out of their churches, and out of their community centers across the state.
I see. And is it your job to run around and set up more of those?
I'm the co-director of the campaign, and my role is to be in charge of the organizing. So a major component of my job is to travel around the state and help volunteers get trained and get organized to work on this campaign. And I also manage a small staff of organizers who are doing exactly the same thing.
I see. And who's funding you?
All of our donations come from citizens. So we don't have any corporate donations or any special interest money. We fund our own campaign. So we've been raising money for the last year from folks who care about climate change, and they think this is good policy and they want to see their sales tax reduced.
I'm sure you're expecting opposition. I heard you talking a little while ago about some of the quarters you're expecting that from, but you know, perhaps you could reiterate that for me.
Well, the value of using the revenues from a carbon tax to cut existing taxes, it allows you to broaden the support. So we think that there's, you know, from a lot of industries in the state, from a lot of average citizens, from a lot of groups and people who haven't traditionally thought about climate policy as something they wanted to engage in, a reason to engage in this. So we think there'll be a lot of folks who you might think oppose climate policy that'll be coming around and saying yes to this measure.
Well, we have seen that the Republicans have, by and large, just taken a stance against any kind of climate measures and in fact, have really tried to poo-poo the science as much as possible.
Yeah, there's a contingency in American politics of folks who really don't want to engage climate change at any level. But I think there's another contingency in the Republican Party, in the center-right, in the center-left, and in the center-center that are coming to a conclusion that we really need to do something about this. And so I think that there are folks who they know they need to say yes to something, and they're going to look at this and see this is a great policy that is going to protect our environment, grow our economy, and cut taxes. And so I think some Republicans really will come around and support this. Maybe not all of them, but definitely some of them.
What kind of measures are you taking, though, to try and keep it nonpartisan? I mean, do you have any sort of strategies for that?
Yeah, we try to tell the truth about the policy, and we try to talk to folks on the center right of the political spectrum all the time. We have an endorsement from the Seattle Business Magazine, you know, so and there's support at the national level for this kind of policy among a lot of conservatives. So really, we're working hard to have those conversations. They're bearing fruit a little bit already, and they will continue to do so. And if you look nationwide, Mitt Romney's chief economic advisor endorsed a policy like this. There are some Republican congressmen and former congressmen that have proposed this idea. So there is support that exists. We just need to build on it and find it and have it coalesce around our policy.
So tell me something about yourself personally. I mean, you know, what brought you to this issue? Mm-hmm. And what kind of work have you done like this before that qualified you to take this job?
Sure. I've been studying or working on climate change for 7 or 8 years. It's a fascinating topic for me because anything else you care about, it becomes a catch-all in climate change. If you care about the environment, it's integral. If you care about farms, it's integral. If you care about beautiful vacation destinations far away, it's important there. So I finally realized everything I cared about in my life could be made worse by climate change, but also could be made better by serious solutions. So I see kind of a hidden opportunity there that excites me. And I'm an avid outdoorsman and a longtime Pacific Northwest native. And prior to this, I've worked on a number of political campaigns and environmental efforts. I most recently served as the field director with a campaign called Yes for Seattle Transit to expand transit service in Seattle that passed last fall. And so that's a project I'm really proud of that I think fits the same kind of values of let's help the environment, let's help average people's lives, and let's make our world more equitable at the same time.
If instituted, the carbon tax would go into effect starting July 1st, 2017, at an initial rate of $15 per metric ton of carbon dioxide. That rate would jump up to $25 per ton in the second year and then climb at a rate of 5% annually until capping off at $100 per ton. In addition to reducing statewide sales tax by 1% and virtually eliminating the business and occupation tax for manufacturers, I-732 also includes rebates for low-income families of up to $1,500 per year. Carbon Washington has until December 15th to collect the 315,000 signatures required to bring the measure before the state legislature.
If the legislature then fails to adopt it, I-732 will be on the November 2016 ballot. This is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Compass. It was serendipity. My wife and I were headed out to the coast anyway to celebrate our 25th wedding anniversary when I spotted the item in the paper. 90-year-old natural history and archaeology writer Ruth Kirk was scheduled to be in Nia Bay that very day for a reading and book signing of her new book about Ozette, the legendary prehistoric macaw whaling village that has been termed the American Pompeii. Buried by a mudslide in the mid-16th century, and thus almost perfectly preserved until excavations under the direction of Washington State University archaeology professor Richard Doc Doherty in the 1970s brought to light six complete longhouses with more than 55,000 artifacts of traditional macaw daily life, Ozette proved a treasure trove which now forms the basis of the Macaw Museum in Nia Bay, which has long been a favorite field trip destination whenever we get out that way. And nobody was better suited to tell the story of that excavation than Kirk, who was there from the beginning as a writer and photographer, and who co-authored with Doc Doherty the original book on the site, and eventually married him after her first husband died. Despite our best efforts, we ended up setting off from Port Townsend a bit later than we wanted, and the long drive out to Nia Bay was delayed even more by what seemed to be an endless succession of slow-moving recreational vehicles. When we finally arrived at the Macaw Marina parking lot, we were late. Somewhat to our surprise, the parking lot was jam-packed, and we noticed several other late arrivals hurrying towards the spacious waterfront hall from down the road. We drove on until we found a place to park and rushed to join them. Luckily, the huge turnout had delayed the start of the program, and as we entered, Macaw Cultural and Research Center Executive Director Janine Ledford was just starting her introductory remarks. Even more luckily, I found the last remaining seat in the front row.
Of course, Ruth Kirk has recently finished this book titled Ozette, Excavating a Macaw Whaling Village. A lot of you have it in your laps, and we're selling them all, so we don't even have any up here. And she describes this as her final project. She began her involvement with the Ozette excavation very early on, and she and Dr. Richard Doherty wrote Hunters of the Whale, chronicling the first stages of the dig through 1974. Some of you have that book with you. I saw Karen bring hers here today. That's a collector's item now. Many people here in this room experienced the Ozette excavation either as field school students, as archaeologists, or as visitors to the site. And she writes about your experiences. Ruth is a gifted storyteller, and we know the value of gifted storytellers. As important, she is our friend, and we know the value of good friends. We appreciate that you've recorded, interviewed, and filmed macaw people, and that you've given those photographs, recordings, and footage to us to cherish and to share with our tribal members. We have just installed a temporary exhibit of your photographs at the museum, of yours and Louie's photographs at the museum. I'm not even sure we told you about that, but...
No.
We really thank you for coming here to Nia Bay today and spending this time with us, and we're very, very honored that you're here, Ruth. So if we could have you come up here now, we would appreciate that. And you can do it.
With that, the smartly dressed petite woman with her white hair and a stylish shortcut and a sparkle in her eye I had noticed sitting directly behind me stood up and walked to the table at the front of the room.
Well, you can imagine, I being a girl from L.A., what it was to walk out to Ozette and see a real coast. I tell you, Santa Monica was never like this. And what a wonderful location for a village, because just about 12 miles offshore is the continental shelf and the upwelling of nutrient-rich water. And because it was sticking out into the ocean, it was the nearest point to land for the migration route of the whales and the seals. And at Ozette, it was clear that about, 95% of the remains of the faunal remains of the foods were marine mammals. And of that 95%, 90% was the seals. Fur seals, big fur seal hunting. So it was excavating a whaling village, and Ada Markishtam commented, We used to wait for when the tide was in, then all go down and pull the whale in with ropes. Once it was 9 a.m. when I got down to the beach, and they had the blubber already off and the meat, just the ribs left sticking up. They had to cut while it was still low tide, blubber and meat and those teeth, the baleen. They were for fish gear and sinew. You cut it and dried it for thread, then you pounded it wet and sewed or used it to fasten a harpoon under the shaft. Oh, the whale, you could use it for everything.
Kirk spoke of the privilege she felt it was to be able to consult many years ago with the Macaw elders who remembered the old ways.
I feel that it was so fortunate there were so many of the elders to talk with during the time that we were filming out here and that the dig was going, people who remembered these things directly and people who had lived at Ozette as children. One year at Macaw Days, several of them, about 15, I think, of the elders were flown by helicopter down to Ozette. And I remember Helen Peterson saying that she had been really lonesome for this beach, Ozette Beach. And on the way down, they had made up a song about a huge bird that carried people in its belly. And its wings were whirling wings, and it had a red eye that kept flashing. And Nora Barker commented, "We left in canoes. Today we came back by helicopter." And you know, when you think about it, that these people had to go through that much change within their own lives, it's really remarkable. I was really pleased to be able to look back or listen back to my tapes and get the voices of elders talking about Ozette. Let's see. Our children should know where we came from. These things prove our heritage, which our older people so many generations have told us about. That was Luke Markostrom. Well, at least to me, Ozette showed me who I really am, and it proved once again that we've been here for a good long time. We're not imports. And that was Irving. The Ozette artifacts give a lot of pride and a real orientation to our culture. My high school daughter worked at the museum as a tour guide, and she came home saying, "I didn't realize what a rich background I have." Mary Lou Denny. Ozette artifacts, they give credence to what the old people were saying. I'd talk with my grandfather, and he'd tell me something about the times, and it was always the same. Oral history was accurate, but now we can see concretely what our grandparents were talking about. They were told to forget everything, and now we're trying to get it back to find out who we are. Now, I suppose everybody has a favorite artifact that came from Ozette. I think for me, it was the cordage, the string. I hadn't been particularly impressed with it as it came out of the ground, but on the last day of the excavation, I was in the lab washing materials that were still coming out of the ground, and I realized then it's fingers. Fingers made this cordage. Fingers tied it, and my fingers are washing it, and fingers to fingers somehow packed a real wallop for me. And because of that, I suppose, I've always liked this passage from Dale Crowes, who was a PhD candidate at Ozette. He wrote, and his dissertation was on the cordage and the basketry at Ozette. And he defined cordage as any rope, cord, or string that is twisted, braided, or a plain strip of bark, limb, twig, or root. And in the Ozette collection, he found more than 2,000 examples. Of them, 530 have knots, of which Crowes defined as any intertwining. This is so academic, isn't it? Any intertwining, looping, bending, hitching, folding, or gathering together one or more pieces of cordage in such a way as to produce a tying together, fastening, binding, or connecting of the length on to or with itself or another length. Any cordage arrangement that meets these criteria is considered a knot, unless it's a tangle. I apologize for my voice. It's a Parkinson's voice, and it doesn't work very well for very long. Let's see. Well, maybe I'll leave it there.
For now, at least.
As Kirk spoke, I had noticed the exaggerated movements that characterize Parkinson's disease, although I didn't notice any problem with her voice, which, like her mind, seemed clear and sharp. There was something else I noticed as I looked around at the huge crowd that had turned out to hear her in remote Nia Bay, and at the baked goods being set out in the back of the room, and as Ledford's description of her as a friend to the macaw sank in, it occurred to me that this event was much more than just another book signing. It was a celebration of Kirk's life, and of that friendship, and then, as speaker after speaker stood to talk not only about that friendship, but of the strong bonds that were built in general between the macaw people and the teams of students and professors who came to help with the dig for 15 years, from 1966 to 1981. I realized I was attending a reunion of people who had participated together in what would probably stand as the most exciting time in any of their lives. The first to speak was Dr. Paul Gleason, whom Ledford identified as the tribe's number one volunteer.
It was quite the occasion in 1966 to hike out the trail, and the white tents were out there, and we settled in. And the first thing we got to do is we got to meet and work and learn from Doc Doherty. One of his main thoughts always was that the archaeology that we were doing was the archaeology for the people who lived around the area where we were, and that we were always to be available and to outreach to the people who were supporting us, the macaw community who had been here for thousands of years. And we worked together, and we began getting invited up to Nia Bay in 1966 to attend weddings, to attend macaw days, to basically learn and meet people here. At the same time, there were still a number of people from Nia Bay coming down and fishing at the mouth of the Ozette River. So we got to meet grandparents and parents and kids and grandkids and great-grandkids all going up and camping at the mouth of the river and talking to them, and so got a real sense, not just of community, but of what family meant. And of course, then the big thing happened in 1970, and the excavation started. That's when we began having everybody working down at Ozette. I can look out here and see quite a few people who worked out there. And looking back, we had people of all ages working for us out there at Ozette and here in Nia Bay getting stuff done. The elders spent a lot of time over at the lab talking with people, helping out, and just explaining what it was that we were excavating, what it was that we were seeing.
The macaw family and community values became a theme of the day. Here is Dr. Gary Wesson, who was a graduate student when he came to work at Ozette.
Just echoing Paul's comments about community, because to me that's one of the most powerful things about Ozette, quite apart from the collection itself, is the community. And for me, as a young and frankly naive graduate student, who didn't know much about anthropology or the world when he first came here, and also as a first-generation American whose own personal sense of family was really microscopic compared to this community's, it was an enormously powerful thing for me to see. It was an enormously deep personal experience, because seeing how powerful you all are with your families really showed me how weak and poor I was in terms of my own family structure. But the interaction between the elders and the archaeologist was an enormously powerful thing, has affected my professional sense of what I do for the rest of the time that I have done this work. And I owe that in very large part to this community and to a small handful of elders who kind of took me aside early in my time here and invested some time and patience in me, both as an individual and as a professional. It was an enormously powerful experience, and I thank you all for it.
Macaw Tribe General Manager Meredith Parker also took the floor and read several passages from Kirk's new book, including one about how the discovery of fishing net in the ancient village led to an important feature in the Bolt decision affirming treaty fishing rights.
Thinking back over the years of the dispute, tribal elder Hillary Irving remembered, "I kept telling them that we had been using nets for hundreds of years. It was just word-of-mouth history, but I knew from my forefathers. I kept telling people and telling people. And then this one day, I came home from a fisheries meeting, and the first person I see is Ed Kaplanahall. And he said, 'You know what they found down at Ozette?' And I said, 'No. What did they find now?' And he said, 'A piece of net.' So I got to say, 'I told you so.'" My people used nets long before any white men came around.
In a long testimonial, Parker reaffirmed the tribe's long-standing friendship with and admiration for Kirk, to which Kirk responded emotionally.
"This book is long awaited, and there's no one better suited or trusted to tell this story than our friend Ruth Kirk. She was at Ozette, she was at Nia Bay, she was at our weddings, baby showers, and funerals. Her dear friend, and for 7 years her husband was Doc. They complemented one another perfectly, and have together told the story of the tribe and the professor like no one else could possibly do. It is an important story, especially meaningful to our Macaw people and our village of Ozette. Thank you, Ruth."
Thank you. Why, thank you. Okay. What a privilege I've had to be here and to know this story and savor the whole relationship. I really, really, it's a highlight of my life. And this is the last book I'm ever going to do. I've been publishing with the University of Washington Press for 50 years, and this is my swan song. But there couldn't be a better topic or a better place. I just feel so privileged, and thank you so much. You're too kind with your remarks, but I like them. Let me read just two more quotes. Ada Markstrom again. "Everybody was all the time going places in canoes then. They were big. They could carry three families at once. We used to go to Victoria after the last of the halibut was dried, 6 or 7 canoes of us. We children were different then. We knew how to sit still. We'd leave at 9 in the morning and get to Victoria at 5 that same day. Grandmother and the other ladies took big bags with baskets they had made, and they went to Hudson's Bay Company and traded for cloth and shawls." And then Lance Wilkie, commenting about Ozette, he had dug down there, been there. Really, he was there a lot, I mean, long sustained time. But thinking of his lasting impression of Ozette, "They must have been awful damn tough. No shoes. Look at what the weather is like out there. You would have thought they'd all have died of pneumonia." But I think Macaws, Ozetters, were tough people. Thanks so much.
The Macaw tribe also presented Kirk with an official resolution of thanks for her years of service and gifts of jewelry, along with a performance of song and dance in her honor. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Mondays and Saturdays at noon, Tuesdays at 5 p.m., and Wednesdays at 10 a.m., exclusively here on KPTZ, the home of eclectic, authentic community radio. And remember, if you have a news tip or story idea of any kind, send an email to news@kptz.org. That email again for news tips is news@kptz.org. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.